How is everybody tonight? Awesome. Good to see you guys. How many people played trivia here? Awesome. Awesome. I probably sound like the spirit of aviation. Thank you guys for coming. This is always an exciting night. Every night here is exciting. I absolutely love getting to be a part of the Theater in the Woods crew. As a matter of fact, before I go any further, let's give a warm round of applause for all the people working backstage to make these productions happen. They're fantastic. Brief, want to say thank you to Mars and M&M. They helped make this program happen as well. Without our sponsors, we couldn't have the funding to fly people in and things like that. So you're in for a really special evening. It's been a great day celebrating women in aviation. And tonight you have a wonderful panel that's going to be here. And these range from all different sort of backgrounds, all different career paths. I think it's very important that people get to hear their story. They're remarkable and inspirational. So you're in for a really wonderful talk. Leading the talk, our MC for the night is Eileen Bjarkman. And Eileen is what I would call EAA family. She grew up here at EAA. She wrote a book called Propeller Under the Bed that I think everybody who has ever come to EAA and all of our new employees should read. It's mandatory reading. But beyond that, she also has been, she's flown more than 700 hours, 25 different types of aircraft, F-16, C-130, C-141s. She retired from the Air Force in 2010 as a colonel. She has been everything from executive director of Air Force Test Center at Edwards Air Force Base, and again, an author, and I consider her EA family. We get to be the proud caretakers of her father's aircraft that set a world record. So let's give a nice, warm EA welcome to Eileen Bjarkman.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah. Okay, we thank you everybody for coming tonight, and we have a wonderful panel lined up for you. I'm going to give a brief introduction to each of our panelists. The first is Margaret Viola. She is the Chief Engineer of Autonomous Systems and Lead Engineer for Sustainment within the Strategic Systems Program Office at BAE Systems. She has worked in technical and programmatic leadership positions for companies across the aerospace industry, including Virgin Galactic, Airbus, and the Aerospace Corporation. So, welcome, Margaret. Casey Anderson is the Director of Flight Test and Operations at Wisk Aero. She has a Bachelor's of Science in Aerospace Engineering from Embry-Riddle. She started her career as a flight test engineer for the U.S. Air Force at Edwards Air Force Base before moving to Silicon Valley. She is a CFI and founded a flying club around a Cessna 140 and built an RV-7 with her partner. Jessica Cox, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with, after a decade of flying, Jessica is known worldwide as the first certified armless pilot in history, and she is the founder of Right Footed Foundation. And Jessica's reputation as a pilot opens doors around the world. And she's going to be talking to us tonight about a very special aircraft that she's been part of designing. So, Zyla Foxlin, who some of you may have seen at the luncheon today, is an engineer, private pilot, and creator who educates more than 1 million followers across her social media platforms. Her YouTube channel spans high-power rockets, custom camper builds, composite fabrication, math and physics explanations, furniture making, luthry, boat building, and the full-scale construction of a Pete and Paul air camper. So. Lori DeBoer is the Deputy Director of Experimental Flight Test at ACE Aeronautics. She is a recently retired U.S. Army Chief Warrant Officer 5 and former U.S. Naval Test Pilot School Rotary Wing Instructor and graduate. And she holds a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering and an MBA in Project Management. And last but not least, Dr. Anita Sengupta is an aerospace engineer, commercial pilot, entrepreneur, and former NASA rocket scientist whose work has enabled missions to Mars, the asteroid belt, and the International Space Station. And she has served as Senior Vice President of Systems Engineering at Virgin Hyperloop, and she has founded a company, Hydroplane Limited, which develops hydrogen fuel cell power plants, so we'll be hearing more about that later this evening as well. So. Okay, so we're going to do some panel questions, and we'll hopefully have a little bit of time at the end for some audience questions and answers as well. So again, the theme of tonight's panel is design, build, test, hopefully in that order. You design something, you build it, and then you test it. Although, as Zyla pointed out this afternoon, you sometimes design, build, test, design, build, you know, go back and forth quite a bit. But let's talk about design first. So the mission of an aerospace vehicle drives its design. So Jessica, can you tell us about the mission of the aircraft you are helping to design and a little bit about the design process? So.
We are designing the Impossible Airplane, which is the first purpose-built airplane in aviation history that can be flown with feet alone in the left pilot-in-command seat. And it has been a 4-year and 1-month journey so far to be able to build something that has never been done before, to build something that is really uniquely engineered, but ultimately with the mission and the vision to convey the message that disability does not mean inability, that we are only limited by our creativity. And this project has been so incredible, how it's opening up the eyes of so many people thinking, well, first of all, people come up to me and they can't believe I'm a pilot and have been for almost 18 years. But now designing an airplane and being a part of this home builder world and making a plane that is accessible and uniquely customized so that I can fly it in a way that makes it so much easier than how I've been flying with my feet up on the controls, occasionally foot falling asleep, getting a Charlie horse. And now to be able to design something with the creativity of some amazing engineers and with the help of so many builders, a kit airplane, an RV-10, that is so that I can fly, I mean, allows me to fly in a very comfortable position with my feet on the floor, very comfortably flying for longer periods because now I have more endurance. I can have more endurance flying in a comfortable position. So it is really conveying that message that disability does not mean inability. We can create possibilities for anyone's ability.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So does anyone else want to comment on something you have designed or been a part of designing? I think Dr. Zengupta and Zyla, you've both had some experience with that. So you want to start with Dr.
So I think what we're working on right now is basically creating an alternative engine for propeller-driven aircraft and rotorcraft. And so that means we're not building a new airplane, but we're facilitating basically emission-free hydrogen fuel cell-based power plant so that you can have the same airplane that you always have, but it will be electric and emission free and perhaps more cost effective. And so that requires doing an electrical design, replacing the combustion engine, which is very different from the way aviation normally does things. And it requires a set of requirements and new training for engineers, new training for AMTs and AMPs, and ultimately selling it to the public to make sure that they want to shift to this new technology, which is, you know, more environmentally friendly.
Zyla, did you want to talk a little bit about some of the things you've done, some of the things you talked about at lunch, maybe?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to take this in a completely different direction. And this is a project that I actually had the privilege of just being an intern on when I was in college. But I worked at Disney Imagineering R&D, and we did a collaboration with Boeing Horizon X, where we wanted to fly a life-size X-wing over the parks for 3 days. And it was really, really cool coming from like a super, super technical background to be on a team that was completely driven by artists. And artists got the final say on absolutely everything, because if something's not canon, it will destroy the magic for the kids, and you can't have that. And so absolutely everything, an artist could like look at your like, you spend weeks working on something, and they'll look at it and be like, vibes off, don't like it. And so learning to design with this like very whimsical objective was super critical, I think, in the way that I started thinking about engineering going forward. So.
Okay. Anybody else have anything they want to say about any design they've worked on? So, okay. We'll move on to the next question. So today, more than ever, the aerospace industry needs to think about sustainability during the design phase. So can any of you comment on any sustainable aviation technologies you are working on? I think we'll start with you, Dr. Sengupta.
So I think everybody in the ground transportation space is trying to shift over to battery electric vehicles, basically, you know, to reduce emissions by charging your car. Unfortunately, batteries are heavy, so they can work well for shorter range eVTOL use cases, but they're probably not a good solution for regional aviation or longer emission profiles. And so for us, we think the solution is hydrogen fuel cell technology, which ultimately, when you store hydrogen as a liquid, can give you better range than the equivalent combustion engine. And the goal for us is twofold. One is to have more energy efficiency. So if you shift over to electrification, you oftentimes get better energy efficiency. And then to reduce emissions, to reduce all the carbon emissions, all the pollution that you would get from a traditional airport, and to reduce noise emissions. Because at the end of the day, the ultimate customer is us, the pilots, but it's also the community in which we fly our aircraft. So if we can be more environmentally responsible and have less of an impact to the local communities where we fly out of as general aviation airports, we can continue to grow people who love aviation.
Casey, I think you've got some involvement there as well.
Okay. Yeah, we're also working on electric aircraft, and it goes back to mission of being the intent of the design. Our purpose is safe everyday flight for everybody. Battery technology, as you mentioned, may not get us very far today, but building the aircraft with that intent in mind, having that design purpose, gets us to the vehicle we need, and as battery technology develops, we can continue to leverage that and have a vehicle ready to use it.
Okay. Anybody else? Any thoughts on that? Okay, so let's move on to the building aspect. What aerospace system have any of you been a part of building, and what are or were some of the challenges involved in building that system? Why don't we start with you, Margaret?
So, professionally and then now personally, I've been lucky to be involved in lots of very different systems, so all kind of disruptive in their own way. At Virgin Galactic, starting back in the day, that was sort of one of the first commercial space companies just starting. So it wasn't a matter of just the technical system itself. It was about creating policies around that system for how to even, use it in a way that could be considered safe, but also not totally constraining. So, part of what I worked on there was the simulator, and that was the test bed for all of the human factors pieces that went into flying the spacecraft. And then after having a really bad day using that simulator to get the company kind of back on its feet. Over to Airbus, where in A-Cubed at the Silicon Valley Design Lab, we were thinking about what if we reimagined the airplane cabin entirely and decoupled the airframe with seats bolted to the airframe to a place where we could just modularize that so we could customize the interior to be all business class, like the 777 that was here before, to something else. And so that has gone on to iterate in different ways. And now, having some fun, we're building an RV-10, my husband and a build partner. So it's fun on a smaller scale to be able to decide, what do I really want? What are our missions that we're going to be putting on this? And one of the things, of course, we're thinking about is the transition from 100 low lead to alternative fuels and looking here on the grounds for what alternatives might be there and designing those in.
Okay. And Jessica, I know you're involved in kind of overseeing and working with the designers there as they build your airplane. Have you seen some challenges involved in doing that?
When we're working with engineers, and I'm not an engineer, really speaking their language and trying to make sure that it's very clear as the user of these unique designs of the impossible airplane, giving them the feedback they need. And one of the challenges I'm finding is that I'm a woman who's lived her whole life without arms, trying to explain it to a guy who has arms. And that whole disconnect is making it very challenging because I have to explain to them, this is all I've ever known. My feet have been my hands my entire life. So when something I think I want to do, I immediately think to my feet. For them, they think about this whole process of how they would do that. So I'm always giving them feedback, letting them know that they don't have to think too much about it because it's so natural for me, and making sure that they understand that this is my norm, and while it's not their norm, because most people are hand users, they can relax a little bit and know that it is it's something that is okay, and I figure this out.
Okay, so Casey, so you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been involved in building?
So WISC is building not only an electric aircraft, but we need to build the airspace that goes with it. Our aircraft is autonomously piloted with our pilots remotely located on the ground. And so we need to work through how does that interact with the airspace today. We're working with NASA and the FAA to run simulations with pilots and air traffic controllers on what could we reimagine the airspace to look like. If we were to modernize how we communicate with ATC, how we interact with air traffic, what would that look like and how do we build that? And that starts with simulating it and testing it incrementally on the ground.
Okay, yeah. And Zyla, you want to talk about your build project, what you're doing right now?
I'm building a paintball air camper. It's probably the least practical airplane you could ever decide to build. It's the very first home-built aircraft to fly on an automotive engine back in 1929. I've spent a long time struggling with what really is the mission objective of this aircraft. And I have decided that I think it's whimsy. I think I just want a sky motorcycle. And I want to honor that era of aviation when we were sort of just chasing the boundaries of what humanity could do. And obviously now, a Model A powered wooden popsicle stick airplane isn't super impressive, but it represents a time when it was, and I think that's really cool.
So I'll just mention that I actually about 10 years ago bought a set of Pete and Paul plans also.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah. Did you build it?
No.
the plans possibly
are,
a wise
The plans
choice.
Are still in the box, so yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, I actually met somebody who's actually building it, as opposed to just thinking about it the way I did. So, yeah. So okay, so let's see. Let's move on to testing, which is my favorite subject. So, so what aerospace system have you been a part of testing, and what are or were some of the challenges involved in testing that system, especially something unusual or unexpected that happened? And let's start with Lori on this one. So, yeah.
I just recently retired from the military, so most of my testing experience was combat-centric, I suppose. And I would say as a flight test team, we don't wonder what's going to go or what could go wrong. We are just waiting for what is going to go wrong. And it's always interesting. So we did a lot of work with upturned exhaust on the UH-60 Blackhawk. For those of you who don't know, that's actually a system that helps to dissipate the heat from our engine. So when the enemy is looking at us with an IR system, it's a little bit more difficult to pick us out. So they were developing more efficient internal components that would actually help that dissipation and keep our signature as low as possible. The unintended consequences were that system worked great. The problem was it was creating what we didn't realize, a re-ingestion into our engine only on the left side. And we ended up doing, if you've ever seen tufting on an aircraft, it's this really technical process where they take little pieces of orange string and stick it with tape all over the aircraft, and then it flies, and someone else takes a picture to see what the airflow actually is in real time on the aircraft. So it looks like this horrible Raggedy Ann doll. And it's pretty embarrassing to fly around in, I'm not gonna lie. But we found some interesting air patterns that were being created by the changes in that, and it was creating some problems for us. So we ended up actually having to create an entire gate structure just along the left-hand side. So unexpected, the system worked the way it needed to work, but it was creating some unintended consequences that we weren't expecting, that was creating problems for actual power and things with the engine itself. So you're always looking not only to what your system creates, but what it actually can affect on things down the line as well.
Okay. Now, Casey, do you want
to? Yeah, so when I was working at Edwards, I had the pleasure of working on the automatic ground collision avoidance system. And this is the system on the F-16 where past the point where the pilot can still recover the aircraft, prior to the point that the aircraft impacts the ground, the system takes over and pulls up. This is intended for CFIT incidents where the pilot's fixated on the ground, or G-lock where they can't recover the aircraft, to get it flying again, for give them time to recover. Testing it was a challenge though. We had several CFIT incidents that we wanted to replicate
with the system to prove that it would have covered those cases. But we also wanted to point the airplane at the ground, wait for the system to recover, and not put our crew in danger. And so safety management in testing is one of the main names of the game. We had to figure out how do we trick the system to give us enough margin so that if it didn't activate, the air crew, the test pilot could recover in time and come back to test another day. And so building that in using simulations, understanding our time safety margin, how much delta we had to work with, to still test the system efficiently, to make sure it was going to work when it had to work, that we didn't leave any loopholes that were going to cause incidents in the field, but also weren't putting our air crew at undue risk. That was one of the more interesting parts of testing, is making sure we're doing it safely.
Okay. Dr. Sengupta, did you want to talk about testing your systems?
I guess I'll give another slightly different example. So most of my career, I did work for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and most of my missions that I worked on were interplanetary missions, meaning you could test something here on Earth, but the Earth conditions are quite different from the way they are on Mars or the way they are on Venus. But one of my projects was to design the supersonic parachute for the Mars Curiosity rover. And so we built a full-scale parachute, went out to desert and tested it, and the thing exploded. Thank goodness it exploded during tests, right? Because you don't want it to explode during landing. And we had so many other colossal failures during that first test program, but we learned from it. We found that we had bad pressure distribution inside the canopy, so we had to redesign. We changed out some of the materials. And then move forward a few years, we did testing in a wind tunnel, also had some catastrophic, fascinating test-specific failures. So what was interesting was a lot of our test failures were actually because of the environment that we were testing in, and naturally you have to, because it's here on Earth. So then you have to kind of translate those failures to how is it actually going to work when it goes to Mars, which is a different atmospheric density, different composition, different speed, and then figure out and make it work. So long story short, we had to do a lot of computational fluid dynamics, wind tunnel testing to understand the physics behind it, and then use Earth-based tests to validate that, and then it has to work the first time when it gets to Mars, but we got it to work. So.
All models are wrong, some are useful.
So Casey, you mentioned using simulation.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of something that we use in the test business for risk reduction. So do any of you want to talk a little bit more about using simulation as part of a test program or using it as a build-up approach to testing? You mentioned like computational fluid dynamics, you know, it's kind of a simulation, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was a full-on research program for us because we had to represent the supersonic aerodynamics of a blood body interacting with a parachute for Mars-type conditions, and so there was no way to do that in test, so we had to use computational fluid dynamics and fluid structure interaction analysis, and then we had to design a test program to validate our simulations so then we could extrapolate to the actual condition. But nowadays, you know, computer programs and supercomputers are great, so you actually can run very detailed time-resolved, spatially resolved simulations.
Mm-hmm. Lori, can you think of anything? So. Yeah.
From my perspective, I mean, we put everything through simulation. I mean, from my perspective, I think from a tester, our simulations, aside from the vehicle themselves, we actually are creating a simulation when we create a test, right? We're actually saying, how do I make this happen, just like she was saying? How do I create the safety margins? How do I light this all out, you know, on my paper napkin and figure out how it's going to work, how I'm going to keep everybody safe, how I'm going to keep it detailed? And then you actually start executing. And I think what I love the most about test is the things that go wrong from the simulations, from the models. Not because I like things going wrong, but I love the synergy of the teams that I work with. I mean, we have amazing engineers, and we have the guys that sit in the back as my flight test engineers as well as the ground engineers. I've got a guy in my ear who's telling me I'm not holding the right airspeed. I've got the guy sitting next to me. I've got engineers at home. We had great simulations on, for example, not just the test article itself, but we had a great simulation on instrumentation that I needed. I had to do elevators up to 14,000 feet in a helicopter while keeping over a specific point that I had to keep within a camera angle. 14,000 feet is really high to keep a very small boat in your camera angle, so they were creating software for me to see in the actual aircraft to tell me where I was to make sure I could stay over that point. Well, the simulation didn't work. Everything was opposite sense. We didn't figure that out till we got there. So I have an entire team. I have an entire team working with me, sending me updates in real time from my engineers in the back. My guys in the front are loading it every time we go out, trying to make the simulation actually start to work for me. So I can actually maintain that position for the test itself, not even for the test article. So I think simulation plays a part for us, not only in the design and the build, but from a testing perspective, how do I simulate, you know, how I'm going to meet the conditions to actually test that article.
Yeah. There's a saying you probably know, all models are wrong, right. Some are useful.
Some are useful.
Right. Right. And so the trick is to use the model in the way that helps you the most, but then always with the real world conditions, go out and see how far off it is.
Yeah.
And then adjust what your numbers were, adjust how you're approaching things, making sure you still have that margin built in the real world. But that practice and rehearsal and simulation, with AutoGCAS, we had a full control room, several people monitoring abort conditions, the crew comm
talking in your ear,
the hot mic between the pilot and the crew, and the timing was very critical, and being able to practice that in a scenario where the pilot's safe and on the ground, drill all of that in for the discipline of the crew, and then when we get to the real world and it's not right, we can adapt much more
quickly. How do you make that adjustment and still stay within the safety margins of the test plan itself and still get the data that you need?
And working in a crew that's operating at that really high level, that's when it's really fun.
And the synergy is just fantastic. On that test, they wanted me to go all the way up and then all the way back down. Well, for those of you who fly helicopters, VRS is a problem. It's called settling in your own downwash. So as you start to descend too quickly, you actually begin to lose lift and the aircraft will actually just start to fall into its own downwash. And so I get halfway through this test that the first time I come down and I land and I'm talking to the engineers, because it's not my engineers, it's the engineers that were doing the project for, and I said, like, is there any reason you can't just play this video backwards? You know, because I'm going up. Couldn't we just go back down? And he looks at me and he goes, yeah, it'll look the same. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going down like that. And that those changes happen real time with the teams, and that's the synergy, that's the magic, that's the fun of it all.
Yeah.
Great. Anybody else? Okay, we're going to change it up a little bit now. We've talked about design, build, test, and we're going to move on to how do you become like one of the women sitting up on the stage here today. We're going to talk a little bit about careers and the academics that's required to move into various aerospace kinds of careers. So what sort of academic pathways are available for people interested in careers in aerospace? And do you have any advice on how to navigate those paths? I'm actually going to ask Margaret to talk first about this, because she doesn't have a degree in engineering. She has a degree in physics, which is very closely related. Engineers take a bunch of physics, but I am curious about hearing about your particular path as a physics major versus an engineering major, and then we'll talk about some of the more traditional paths. So.
Sure. I mean, some might say it's a bit of a random walk or a bit lucky, but I didn't honestly know going in the difference between like the hard sciences or engineering, and then as I was, you know, in it, I chose a school, the University of Chicago, that didn't in fact have an engineering department for reasons you can look into that go way back 100 years. But a pure science-based school, we're going to do this. But it turned out to be a great match for me, because the first principles thinking you learn in physics, we like to call it, I think is useful, helping me manage or be a pain to some of the engineering teams I've worked with, because where I think in the engineering discipline, you know, you're given formulas, you understand properties and principles, and you kind of like turn the crank a little bit to get to a result or apply a set of techniques to get a particular result. What I look at doing is, well, what's the origin of this? What are the governing principles and how can we use that from a different perspective? And so I apply that now kind of like up and down and all over the place, what I call organizational physics, which is a bit of the systems engineering, a bit of the programmatics to make these projects go from whatever part of the life cycle they are to where we need them to be next. So I would say there's probably no wrong way to get into it, but starting in a technical basis, of course, is essential.
Okay. Dr. Sanbuka, let's talk about your academic career here, or your pathway through how you got where you were. So
I would say I keep on learning something new every day, most importantly, but I think I always wanted to get my PhD because I always loved doing research, and so I think there's a time and a place for every discipline, every type of degree that you would get. So with a PhD, you can do, you know, research to develop new technology, or you can do fundamental research, but when you implement any new technology, any new program, it takes so many different people from so many backgrounds, from so many disciplines, right? So like we have electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, we had a chemist scientists on the team, we've had pilots on the team, we have aviation maintenance technicians. So when you do something really complicated in aerospace, you actually have to have this massive multidisciplinary team to make it work. So I think in the aviation space, there's everything from being a researcher to being a pilot to being an aviation maintenance technician. I would argue it's a whole new class of aviation maintenance technicians that will come out as a result of, you know, electric propulsion in aircraft. But it really kind of depends what you feel passionate about. And you also can move around. So I know people who've gone and gotten an AMT afterwards and then focus on that, or vice versa. They had an AMT and then they went and got an engineering degree. But I feel like in aerospace, there's so many opportunities now.
Okay. Lori, do you want to talk about, because you went through test pilot school, so you want to talk about kind of your journey?
Sure. So the Army offers, this is not my plug for the Army, by the way. I get no recruiting points. But the Army offers a unique opportunity because their flying program for warrant officers is available without people having or a requirement to have a degree. So you can actually come in and fly in the Army without having a degree. And we do have some test pilots that have gone through that have degrees that are not technical. My stick buddy, I think, had a social science degree when he went through. So you can get there. Not having a technical degree makes what is already a difficult school more difficult if you're going to go to test pilot school. It is a lot of physics, a lot of engineering that you need to get through it. But it's doable. It's just the tough road. I do have an engineering degree, and it has helped me all the way through. And I've enjoyed being able to apply that as well as to do flight tests as well. But it does offer other opportunities for those who don't necessarily have a hard technical degree if they want to fly. If you want to test, the competition is more difficult if you don't have some type of a math, science, or technical degree. But it's a different path anyway.
Casey, now how about you? I'd call you kind of a traditional path because you went through Embry-Riddle, right?
I did, yeah. I went to Embry-Riddle Prescott, studied aerospace engineering, moved over to Edwards Air Force Base, which I think is actually a great example of somewhat of a non-traditional engineering path because I didn't know it was an option when I started. Going to work for the Air Force as a civil servant and getting to work with the military jets, work side by side with the test pilots, and even for some folks get to fly backseat. As a civilian for the military is an amazing opportunity that I didn't know was out there. Stumbled into that, found that having a pilot's license made it much easier to communicate with the test pilots. I didn't want to be a pilot for a living because I enjoyed flying and I was afraid that flying for work would be too much. So I followed that engineering route and found that really we become translators. We translate between engineers, we translate to pilots, we translate to program management to try to explain what's going on. And so really the foundational skill that I've leaned on is communication. If you can talk to leadership, if you can talk to the folks on the ground, if you can get everyone working towards the same big picture, the technical background helps with those translation skills, but that's where people really shine.
Okay. So did you get your pilot's license when you were at Embry-Riddle?
No, they told me engineers don't fly.
Okay.
I had my pilot's license in high school before I went to Riddle. When I was a freshman, I went to join the flying club, and they told me engineers don't fly, so I went to fly elsewhere.
Wow. So that's unbelievable.
It kind of was.
I think there's a lot of engineers up here that have pilot's licenses.
Would disagree.
So, like all of us, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, anything anybody else? Oh, just in terms of challenges, academic challenges, do any of you remember any particular courses or any time when you were going through where you had a challenge? I know, Zyla, you had the one. Maybe you could talk about that, where you had the challenge with the robotics. So you told the story at lunch, but you never told us what happened at the end.
Yeah. Well, I became an engineer, so yeah. I did win at the end.
Get it to work.
Yeah. I actually really like this question because I think I struggled through all of school. I never found a home in a school setting. I really hated being in a classroom. I always wanted to just be building something and working on projects and working towards an end goal that felt tangible to me. And I grew up I'm Asian. I grew up in an immigrant community of mostly Asians where like testing is like what you, that is your future. If you don't do well in the SATs or you don't get a high GPA in college, then you're gonna have no future. And I wish that someone had told me when I was younger that it actually doesn't really matter. Once you leave an academic environment, if you don't wanna stay in academia, then the world is your oyster, and actually having all those skills from doing projects, it was so much more impactful in the rest of my life than a degree.
I love that. I would just love to add on to that, because I also didn't, you know, I got to physics at University of Chicago, and I had this sense that, you know, at that time the commercial space industry was just beginning. Like, it was a sense that I had here from Oshkosh that we were on the precipice of doing really cool stuff, and that cool stuff was not going to be happening in the basement of the high energy physics lab or in any of my classes. So it was like, how do I get to that? And all of my peers at the time were just going to go on to grad school and like work at CERN and stuff. And to me, I was like, but you know, that's not it. But being willing to communicate, being able to understand beyond the technical point, like what is the goal? What is the cost? What are the risks? How do you communicate those things big picture? And then being really open-minded, kind of like, yeah, open the world up and just being willing to take a swing, like take a couple of risks, which you can do really at any age, but especially when you're young outside of those traditional paths. And you know, I've ended up in a more sort of corporate traditional career, but I love it now. Like, I love being able to work with these teams and chew on hard problems and have to kind of be like a little, I don't know, sometimes I joke, like a cockroach in the system to like skitter around with people and figure out ways to get things done. I think that's great. So yeah, I think not being discouraged. If the thing in front of you isn't exactly it yet, like go through, keep going, and like new stuff is gonna open up.
One more thing to add on that, and something I saw a lot is the folks coming into these technical majors are at the top of their high schools. Mm-hmm. High school maybe came easy for them, and they get to these colleges, they're in a new environment, it's a different sort of organization, and they struggle, mm-hmm. and they get C's, mm-hmm. or they fail tests, mm-hmm. and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You're gonna get through it if you keep going, if you reapply yourself, and keep moving towards what you want. Don't let that one thing slow you down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think probably all of us have failed a class, especially, not a class, but a test in engineering. So, yeah.
Differential equations.
I took that three times.
Hated it. Yeah, I still have nightmares about that thing tumbling.
My first day.
Yeah. Okay, so we kind of started touching on the next question here, and we'll go into a little bit more detail, is because there's lots of different career paths out there. I mean, you already heard a couple of them mentioned here, and we'll talk about them some more, but we've got large corporations, small companies, we've got startups, military, and government civilians, and entrepreneurs, and academia. So why don't we start with entrepreneurs, because we got a couple of them sitting right here. So Jessica, do you want to talk about your kind of path into being an entrepreneur?
Yeah. Sure. So basically, I was so inspired by aviation, and as we all are, I'm sure, in some way, is that I knew it would be an amazing tool to really challenge the expectations for people with disabilities. And why not use it as a way to break the stigma and start a foundation, create a nonprofit that focuses in on empowering children with disabilities who are told time and time again, you can't do it because you have this disability, and showing them that the sky is the limit and that aviation is possible for anyone. I mean, there's so many different things from, you know, not just being a pilot, but there's so many other possibilities. And so Right Footed Foundation International really wanted to use aviation as a tool to inspire people and build a plane and make this a very good visual medium to show the world that we can create possibilities in the cockpit. And these possibilities are engineering unique designs that have never been done before. And use it as a tool to really stretch people's belief in what is possible for someone with a disability.
Okay.
Giving accessibility. Accessibility to the thing that we all love so much, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Zyla, you kind of started out in, I think, a traditional company and then transitioned to being an entrepreneur.
Certainly being a creator was not on my bingo card. But I did this really, really fun thing, which is graduate engineering school straight into a global pandemic. And the full-time job offer that I had lined up
was that challenging?
Huh?
Was that challenging?
I mean, I'm just grateful that I didn't like lose, you know, like senior prom or something to COVID. That would have been, but I, the job offer that I had lined up from an internship was a very like in person, it was a theme park that I'm not going to name. And when the theme parks in Asia shut down, they like pulled everything, froze everything. And so suddenly this future that I had been working towards and building towards like my whole adult life, all of 4 years, had just like disappeared in front of me, and I had absolutely no idea what to do. So I just did what I always did, which is just to keep building projects and things that I thought were cool to the best that I could with the resources that I had. And I just got really lucky sort of at the peak of the quarantine. Everyone's trapped at home trying to watch as much DIY content as they could. I like sort of snuck in there. But it's been a really, really fun journey. I think something I was so scared of going into engineering was being like trapped behind a desk or spending my entire career developing like one gear that was gonna go on like one robot, and that was a 15-year project. And in the job that I have now, I basically get to learn something new every month. I get to challenge myself in a different way with every project, and I'm perpetually grateful that I get to do that.
Oh, that's great. Sounds like fun. So.
It is kind of fun.
So yeah. Casey, you were so you started out as a government engineer, but then you transitioned into kind of a startup, I think, right? So do you want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned your government career, you want to kind of talk about making that transition into the startup?
Yeah, so I was working at Edwards, which is an amazing place to work from a technical perspective and a terrible place to live from a personal perspective. And I was looking around to where are the other places to do flight tests, and because of the safety factor to the population, most of them aren't great either. But I found a small company that was doing flight tests in New Zealand. I was like, well, it's a startup. I don't know how long it's going to last, but let's go do flight tests there while I can. So I moved up to Silicon Valley for a company called Kitty Hawk. And they were doing electric aviation. They had a couple different models. And I really, it felt like a leap because government service is a very secure thing. There's traditional paths. You know what paths are worn and where you're going to go. Moving into the startup, I didn't know what was next. I didn't know how long it was going to last. And I'm 8 years later, I'm still there. And every time I think about changing, the job changes on its own because we're still developing and we're innovating and growing as a company as well. I'm watching the company grow from a research and development company into a mature aircraft OEM. And I call us in our adolescent phase right now, where we're not sure which one we want to be yet. But that change in itself has fulfilled my career in wanting to see change in what I work on. The scope of whether it's program management or technical or people leading has offered those opportunities. So while it felt uncertain at the time, it's been an interesting path of a lot of opportunities.
Great. So now, Lori, why don't you talk a little bit about your military career? You know, you talked about test pilot school already, but maybe talk a little bit about, you know, kind of a typical path through a career. I realize that yours is warrant officer, but you know, just kind of talk about how, you know, people, as when they come in the military, you know, at first they're being bossed around, and as they get more senior
in rank, to be a warrant officer.
As they get more senior in rank, you know, they take on more responsibility, that sort of thing. So yeah.
For the aviation perspective, we have again a career path in the Army that actually allows you to come in straight in to be specifically a pilot, which is unique to the Army as well. So you can literally come straight in as a warrant officer, which is what I did. We call it street to seat. So I joined the military at 25, and I was literally an officer 5 weeks later and walking down the street, and I didn't even know who to salute. I had a specialist with me, and I'd be like, if I'm supposed to salute somebody, tell me, you know? And that's unique. And then we also have people within the military itself that are enlisted first and then switch over to become either what we call RLOs, real live officers, or take the warrant officer track. So you can do either of those. All of our crew chiefs and our flight test, our flight engineers are all enlisted, and they have the opportunity to put in flight packets and become pilots as well. And then you kind of just move up through the ranks. I actually ended my career as a CW5. There wasn't anything higher than that for me. The chief warrant officer track stops at 5, which is a really great place to be for 10 years, because every time somebody tells you to do something you want to do, you can always say, well, what are you going to do? Not promote me? Because there's no W6.
So it makes you the most dangerous person in the room some days. If anybody's a warrant officer out there, you know what I'm talking about. But I wanted to, can I touch on something that she said? I've had the weird transition because I ended my career in June and I started this new career with what is also a startup company, Ace Aeronautics. And they've grown from 60 people to 300 people. What I find fascinating about aviation right now and aviation design, development, and build is the fact that people are literally in their own homes starting up companies and creating products. And it's actually literally starting to challenge some of what we consider to be those you know, I don't know, Goliaths.
Establishment.
The establishment, you know, the Boeings, the Sikorskis, the Bells. We have companies now, they're starting to come to us and want to do joint ventures with us in some of the things that we're creating. And I love it because it's pilots making, it's like ForeFlight. Anybody here use ForeFlight at all? Why is it great? Because pilots made it, right? So pilots know exactly what we want and what we want to see. And then, but we don't have the engineers. So then we have to find our favorite engineers, you know, and say, hey, come work with me. And what I love about the company I'm working with right now is we're doing joint ventures with Garmin, creating a G5000 cockpit. So it's a full glass cockpit that we're remodifying back into old Alpha and Lima models that the Army is divesting, and then we're selling those. But it is an amazing cockpit. Garmin is amazing. But we have meetings with them every week, and I can say, hey, that little widget that you're doing over here below 40 knots, yeah, we hate that. Can we fix that? And they're like, yeah, sure, that's a software drop. And they'll make a note. So the responsiveness of having these smaller companies working together is amazing, especially from a military perspective, because I was always testing with these giants where you'd say, hey, we hate this. And they're like, yeah, that sucks. And, <you're> like, and so we just hate it forever, you know, and then that's just the way it was. So it's just, it's neat to see that responsiveness and to see it's us at ground level that are actually creating those changes and creating those products now. And it's just a different, it's very different from, I think, the what I was growing up in, I guess, with the behemoths, right?
Okay, and Dr. Sengupta, and so you had kind of a path too, where you started out with NASA and then got into other things. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I think we all have one degree of separation from Boeing, because right. My first job out of school was Boeing. And I was actually just going to go straight get my master's degree, but then they came and interviewed my school. I'm like, oh, awesome, free trip to California. So I went to California. I'm like, I want to live in California. And then I'm like, and we'll pay for your pilot's license, and we'll pay for your master's degree. I'm like, this sounds great. So, and it was a good experience because I learned a lot of, like, I did launch vehicle design for my first job. That was too big of an entity for me to feel. I was like a little, you know, tiny little plankton in an ocean, basically. So that's why it wasn't a good position to be a very, very young engineer at such a big organization. And then one of my professors pulled me into NASA. So I worked there for a long time. And even that was fun. You get to do a lot of interesting interplanetary missions. But once again, I still felt like I was not making enough of an impact personally, because it's a huge bureaucracy, and government bureaucracies are worse than corporate bureaucracies, if you ask me. And you can quote me on that.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, time for something new. And I got recruited out to join a very well-funded startup, which eventually got, like, the title got changed to Virgin, the Hyperloop, and then I was like an organizational leader. I'm like, cool, but I don't really want to do organizational leadership. It was too much, you know, nonsense. And so then I used it as an opportunity to start my own business. So I went from something huge to something really tiny, which is not my small business, but we're growing it, obviously, to be bigger. And I think what's so interesting about aerospace, and I think everybody is mirroring this, is that aerospace, new aerospace, isn't big aerospace, it's tiny aerospace. It's tiny little companies that are having really unique expertise. And of course, sometimes people want to have their companies bought out, right? Because, and then a big company will buy out and everybody cashes out, you know, from the founding team and early employees. But that is driving innovation. And as somebody who has a small company that doesn't want to have it bought out, it's fantastic. So I've never had more fun in my life than having my own business. The only bad part, I'll say, is doing all the business side of stuff is awful. Like all the paperwork, the insurance, and all the past stuff is terrible. Oh my God, yes. Hate that, but engineering, love it.
Great. So Margaret, what if you asked? So you've had more of a, I'd say, traditional engineering career with some of the larger corporations. Do you want to talk a little bit about your journey through that?
Sure. So I think my fascination with sort of the big, traditional, like, huge systems, big history companies started because my first few jobs were in the opposite of that. And so having seen some things go wrong and some really bad days, really good days too. I wanted to know, but like, how, like, what are the tools used to make these systems that we rely on in, you know, defense and aerospace and historically here at Oshkosh that we celebrate. And some of the best leaders I had experienced early in my career had gone through that, Luke, and had all these tools in their belt. It seemed like they knew exactly what technique at any point to solve a set of problems. And so I wanted to be someone who could experience what those were. So it's been really cool to me to go into, you know, spent a few years working for the Missile Defense Agency through Aerospace Corporation for a system that's now been in place for 20 years, getting replaced, going to be there for the next 50 years, right? That has, you can look it up, you know, a singular, very important mission that will hopefully never, ever need to be used, but requires thousands of people working on it. And even though I'm just kind of like one little person in this huge system, for me, being able to look at that and see, oh, there's like still sets of common problems and questions. How do you right-size the modeling and simulation so it doesn't take over the whole thing, but you still get the answer that you need? How do you work through this? Getting to work with people who have expertise at every level, to me, is just fascinating and it's fun. And so at BAE, I get to do a little bit of both. On the one hand, my homeroom is doing some of that. How do we sustain something that's going to be in the ocean, kind of, you know, around, waiting, hopefully never be used, for the next 80 years? And how do we maintain that in a world where we've got AI and we want to do things more efficiently, but you don't want to break what's not broken, right? But I also am, like, helping the company learn how to get into a much smaller space and like build drones and flight test drones. And hey, we need to do thermal management on our drones, but we need to do it for the computer chips that are inside the drones, not for like the outside, because we're not going to be flying in the exo-atmosphere. So how do we right size policies now at both scales? So I think, you know, it's new every day and fun every day, and I just have a great time doing my work.
Okay. Good. So now you've seen the gamut of you know, career paths represented up here. So we've touched on this just a little bit. Some of you have touched on this a little bit in your previous answers. But you know, some people want to remain deeply technical for their whole careers. But most people at some point in their career, whether they want to or not, are going to be in some kind of a leadership role. And that might just be mentoring. But it might also be a team leader, supervisor, or something in project management or corporate leadership. Do you have any advice for people who are transitioning to those new roles, you know, where you're moving more into that leadership role? So, who wants to take that one on?
I can start.
Okay.
I think my piece of advice would be to look up to where you want to go next. Find the person in the role that you admire, either how they handle their job or whether it's on the personal side or the technical side, and ask them if they will be your mentor. Mm-hmm. Make sure you always have a mentor for the role that you're going for, and find that person yourself. Reach out and build those connections. Sometimes the companies will help by giving you training or education on generic leadership, but I think building those networks so that you have someone to call when you have a question. No one knows how to do everything right out of the gate. You don't get a course in, now you have gotten an A in leadership, congratulations, maybe the military, but in the civilian world, less so. And so finding those people that you can lean on when you have questions, I think, has been really critical for me.
Yeah. I was going to say, I 100% agree, and then I'll also go in an opposite direction. Don't forget that the people that are on the floor are your best source of information, because like the company we're working on now, we went to them and said, hey, we're building these, we're building this. Are there efficiencies that we can do? Like, what are the hangups? What are we costing you in time? Like, what are our procedures that are creating problems? And the feedback we got was really amazing. I mean, we changed a lot of the processes that we have, and we're cutting down the time per aircraft and the time per harness and things like that. But getting their feedback, because then it's also their buy-in, right? Because you're interested in the product because you're actually being asked to make the positive changes for yourself that are also positive changes for the company. So you have to get those mentors that help you grow, but then you also have to remember to talk to the people that are actually down in the weeds, because they're going to bring you a lot of information that you may not see up at that leadership level that could change really large things for the company overall. I mean, I think we forget that sometimes.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I guess I would just like to add that I think I spent the first part of my career wanting to be taken very seriously and like being very seriously technical, and then kind of have reached like an inflection point where it's now important that I am able to communicate to people who are not technical the right information in a way that they can grasp and that they stick with. And that means, as my favorite boss would say, being like horsey ducky about certain things in a way that's like very genuine and with them. And so I think, you know, no matter where you are, remembering that if you can maintain relatability to people who are not technical, so, you know, the accounting side, the program management side, the schedulers, and build those communication skills so you have that bridge, makes you like really versatile. And, you know, now it's what I do, essentially. But, you know, no one tells you that, right, at the beginning of your career. You kind of got to learn that the hard way.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I would say this is something that's really important to me now. As you get older, you want to help people even more. But it's that ultimately, as a manager, you're there to grow those people, to help those people, to make them successful. I mean, the team is only successful because everybody is successful. And another piece of advice that I got from one of my managers years ago was that basically you, as the manager, need to take all the brunt of everything yourself to protect, you know, the people down below as well. Like, you should never pass down the pain to them. That's not right. So you have to be there to support them. But ultimately, you're supposed to be their mentor and make sure they grow and get everything they need and feel happy, and then they'll stick around your company for longer. So, and actually my second in command, she is my former intern, so she was my intern for 2 summers like years and years ago at NASA, and now she's second in command at my company. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of internships and growing really, really young people to be successful in their career. So
great. Okay, we're getting down to the last little bit here before we start audience questions. So any of you can answer this. You don't have to all answer it, but any of you can answer this one. What would you tell your younger self, you know, looking back, on what you've learned now, you know, what do you wish you had known when you were younger, and what would you tell your younger self? So, Jessica, did you want to take that one first?
Well, I think that people... What I would tell my younger self is that aviation has some incredible possibilities. And I was always terrified of flying, and just the thought of losing contact with the ground just really made me uncomfortable. But what I also realized through aviation is when you face your fear, when you face any fear for that matter, you actually become a better version of yourself and you rise to the challenge. And when you do that, you stretch yourself. It's a little uncomfortable, sometimes it's scary, but in the end, you come out a stronger person. And I think that is what I hope to instill to the younger children in my nonprofit, Right Footed, is that don't be afraid to do things that scare you a little.
To add on to that, I would say don't be afraid of interacting with people. Whatever their level is, whether they're the CEO or colonel or maintainer on the floor or intern, they're all human, they have a perspective, they have the same fears and concerns that you do. You may be afraid to ask them a question, but they may be afraid to come to someone else. And so once you start engaging with those people, you open up so many more doors and so many more possibilities, and you talk to them on the same level, you build that respect and that trust, and you have a new piece of your network to work with. And so don't be afraid to interact with everybody and anyone you find.
Okay, anyone else?
I'll do the same one that I gave in my talk earlier, which is that engineering, designing, building, flying, all of these things are skills. You're not born with them. It's something that you have to build through practice. And so you can't be comparing yourself to people who have decades more experience or practice than you do. You just have to put in the hours and get the practice, and then you'll develop the skills.
Don't be afraid of change. I love my life, and I've had a million curveballs, but every single day I get up because I love what I do. I love the team that I work with, and if that's not where you are, don't be afraid to change that. I mean, there are so many possibilities. I mean, we've talked about there's been a million paths to get here, so don't think that you're stovepiped into one path for your life. I mean, it's always possible to shift, but you have to have that courage to actually to go after that, to go after what your passion is and what makes you passionate and makes you want to be a better person, to grow and to face your fears. And you just have to be able to want to do that and to reach for it. But.
Did you want to say anything?
Sure. Yeah, I think like it's about asking questions. But for me, I feel like my younger self, like high school self, didn't necessarily know how to ask the question or like how to articulate wasn't clear to me in my mind. And so I think you know, maturing for me has meant being able to ask better and better questions, and that's a practice, you know, we can all use, like, you're never great at that, but really distilling for yourself, like, what is uncomfortable for me here, or, like, what is it that I feel like I don't quite understand? Like, that's a great practice, and that, I mean, that is the art of engineering and the art of science itself, is trying to, like, ask the better question wherever you are. So had someone, like, knocked me over the head and said that, I think, you know, more and more worlds would have opened up, but I try and do that now.
Great. Okay, last question, and nobody has to answer this if they don't want to. So is there anything else you would like to mention to our audience here that we haven't already talked about? So. No takers? Okay.
I'm going to put a shameless plug in here. Sure. I'm actually going to be having a meet and greet with Mirko at the Lycoming booth tomorrow at 11 a.m. And Mirko's the one who's the artist behind the Impossible Airplane. And I just want to invite everyone out, if that's okay, if I put in that plug for anyone who's interested in coming to the Lycoming booth, 11 a.m. tomorrow.
Okay, got it. So, okay, let's, do we have some questions from the audience?
We do.
Okay.
Whoa.
I have no idea how loud that is for everybody. I love the sound of my own voice, let me tell you that. First question is for Zyla. Zyla, you recently started working on your Pete and Paul, and then you went with a different covering source. Can you explain why? And they think it's awesome, but can you sort of give some feedback as to why you did that?
Covering? Was that the...
Yeah, you changed your cover.
You went fiberglass on the Pete and Paul.
I did. My answer is really goofy. It's like because I wanted to, and I thought it would look really cool. My background's in boat building and cedar stripping. I've always thought it was really, really beautiful. What I learned is that it's kind of misunderstood by the aviation community. When I cedar stripped the airplane, everyone thought I added like 65 pounds to the tail of an already famously tail-heavy airplane. And I will not know until I'm done with the airplane and I've, you know, it's like about ready to fly. But my hypothesis is that it will actually end up lighter than had I covered it entirely in fabric and open paint, which can add a huge amount of weight. People really don't think about how heavy paint is. And I skipped that by cedar stripping it. The sides of the Pete and Paul came out to 5 pounds each, fiberglassed, full length of the aircraft, and then the turtle deck came out at 3 pounds. So super, super light. And the answer is just whimsy. I thought it would look sick. and it does.
That's where the best ideas start.
The next question I have is, are there any apps that any of you recommend that people use to get better at the types of jobs you do?
Better at what?
Any what?
Better at the jobs you do?
Apps. Are there any apps that you would recommend somebody at home that wants to get into it, like on their phone or iPad? That they should use that would help them get better to pursue a career that each of you do.
That sounds like a good career opportunity for somebody to develop, though.
I use apps that I hate. Like Teams.
We have a few we'd like to burn. Yeah. Teams is definitely on the list.
I've introduced a lot of professional contacts to the app Sky Cards, which is like Pokemon Go for airplanes. And it's earned me a lot of professional bonus points, although I would not say it makes you any smarter.
Many of us backstage have been playing Sky Cards, and it's been a good week here.
I'm so disappointed. I've been working almost the entirety of Oshkosh, and I didn't get to sit there at any of the mass arrivals and catch all the airplanes.
That's a good question, though. I think I'd like to research that a little bit. There probably are some educational apps. But I'm just not aware of them, so yeah.
We're all probably running around too busy on our Teams apps and answering all of our meetings, right?
We have someone here who is going into their junior year of high school. They're interested in becoming an aerospace engineer, and they're wondering where everyone went to college and if they have any advice for what to look at in an engineering college.
I'll start this off as to what not to look at. I started off in Florida Tech. And the temptation to use your books as a pillow while you're on the beach because you're convinced that osmosis might actually work
I'll save you the trouble, it does not. So try not to pick a place that's too much fun because it's very distracting from an engineering perspective. I finished my degree in the University of Alaska Fairbanks, by the way. It was the differential equations that did it, I'm just saying.
I took Diffie Q 3 times, I understand.
Twice, hated it.
I would just offer some advice, which is, you know, money is a real thing, cost is a real thing. So, and I will say, as somebody who hires people all the time, I do not look like, did they go to school XYZ, Ivy League? So I think you do have to find something which is something you can afford. First of all, is the most important thing, because you can't expect your parents to get their second mortgage on their home to pay for your private school education. There's that. If you get scholarship, great. The other thing too is make sure that it has the type of campus life that you want. Make sure that it actually has the program that you want. Are you a person who likes to be a part of clubs? Somebody who wants to be part of do they have like a solar car racing team? Like, make sure that the school actually has things beyond just the coursework. But it almost doesn't really make a difference where you go to school, as long as you're happy there, it's a good environment for you, you do well. And then this is another piece of advice for young people, do internships. Whatever you do, do at least one internship, because that will give you a huge step up than all the other interns or all the other students who didn't get an internship getting your first job. So that didn't help probably, but.
Yeah. And do be careful with your social media. That's a high recommendation for me. Like, your social media is one of the first things that we look at when we go to hire somebody. I don't know if you guys do or not, because it gives you a pretty good insight into the person. And I'm not saying don't have fun on your social media, because I have mine and it's crazy. But just be cognizant that you are presenting yourself to the world, and you are presenting yourself, because there's a lot of young people that come back to us and go, why didn't you hire us? Why didn't you interview us? And I just really want to say, look at your social media. I mean, and so that's probably one of my biggest advices that I wouldn't have given 10 years ago, but that I would give today. And you have to be cognizant of how you're presenting yourself. I mean, have fun, enjoy it, but be cognizant of the idea that people are looking at it.
I work in social media, and I still stalk people's social media before I hire them. And I'm judgy.
I'm going to use that on the next one.
Judgy.
Casey, did you want to say anything about Embry-Riddle?
Yeah, what I appreciated most about Embry-Riddle is the student-to-faculty ratio and the amount of time available, the office hours that they've had for the professors that you were taking the courses from, but even the professors that I wasn't taking courses from, that I was going to be taking from in senior year, knew who I was as a freshman, and I could start learning from them and interacting with them and even learning from their background in industry, because most of their professors hadn't been just academia, they'd come from the industry, whether that was Boeing or the Air Force or JPL, various degrees. So that opened up a lot of opportunity for me to just pick their brains, learn from them, and also when I did have issues with coursework that I needed help with, that relationship existed to go work with them.
Okay. I think mine would be, I don't think I realized going into college that the thing I would value the most out of the college experience is the friendships that you build and the kind of people that you're surrounded with, I think, are what make or break your college experience. And so I'd say tour, if you can do an overnight stay at a college that you're like very seriously considering, see if you really click with the other students that are there. Because I, to be honest, I didn't click with the students I stayed with, and I just like was like, it's probably a fluke, it'll be fine. And then I didn't really build any like friendships that lasted the way that my friendships in every other part of my life have. And that's what I think would have really benefited my college experience.
Is that support structure?
Yeah.
Any other questions?
We do. one of the questions here is, technology is increasing at a speed faster than traditional testing phase used to be. How do you focus on what matters to keep it all safe?
That's loaded.
Yeah, that's incredibly loaded. Well, from, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I'm actually thinking about this different from my professor hat on. I am somewhat terrified by the reliance that students have on AI. right? Because they are becoming like, that's the source that they go to for information. And oftentimes from like an engineering perspective, it gives you the wrong answer completely. So I am worried that there's gonna be too much of a reliance on that technology and people aren't gonna think, and I keep on thinking back to the movie WALL-E where everyone doesn't do anything, they just get overweight sitting on a chair. So I'm worried about that aspect of technology. So I have a policy in my company that you cannot put our information into AI tools and you cannot use it to solve the problem. You could do it for background research, but I know that's not quite an answer to your question, but it's something that I look at every day and I'm worried about. So
I'll build on that answer though. The technologies we've been talking about is aviation. There are a lot of guardrails in aviation to keep it safe, to make sure that it is well tested before it goes out to the public, that the public can rely on the certification process. Things that don't go through that process have a smaller scale, smaller impact. Our experimentals are home built. And so we have the guardrails at the right levels to make sure that we are keeping people safe. The AI technology you're talking about doesn't yet. And so that's where I share your concerns of we need the guardrails, we need the regulations to know how to use it to keep it safe.
That was really well put.
Okay.
We have one final question here, and that is simply, do you have any tips for being a young woman in aviation and overcoming imposter syndrome?
Just keep going.
Yeah. Imposter syndrome.
Oh, imposter syndrome?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I have it every day.
The boys don't know what they're doing either.
Reference back to they're just people. They have concerns and stresses and anxieties that they're not sharing either. Everyone is human. Just keep doing it.
And I don't know how anyone else feels, but obviously aviation, military aviation is overwhelmingly male. But I will tell you that my experience, I have nothing bad to say. I had the most amazing mentors. I had the most amazing commanders. Everyone was encouraging. Everyone was supportive. The people who worked for me were phenomenal, and I'm still really great friends with almost all of them, as well as all the people that I worked for. So at least from my perspective, aviation and military does it right. They don't really care whether you're a girl, whether you're a boy. As long as you do the job, you pull your weight, it sort of all goes out in the wash. That's not necessarily the case everywhere, and I understand that, but don't be afraid to go, because when I went in, there weren't many women at all. And so don't be afraid to actually take on those challenges, because I don't think it is what you think it is. It's really wide open for you to be as successful as you choose to be.
Anybody else? Okay. I think we'll call that a wrap. So thank you very much to our panel.